quantum theory. Now, it might be that this is the second or third time that you hear this already today, but maybe this, there are some new aspects as well that I will address there. Then, so if you talk about axioms, you have to set up a mathematical framework where you formulate the axioms. And in this case, this is the framework of general probabilistic theories. So I will say quite a lot about the physics background of this framework and also how it works mathematically. And of course, for many of you, this will be like something you already know very well, but I think I'll include this just to have completeness, right? And then the axioms, so I'll tell you what our axioms are, and I'll also try to explain what they mean physically. Then I hope the time is enough to give you an idea at least how we derive the Hilbert space formalism from the axioms. And in particular, I would like to use the time to show you why quantum bits are actually three-dimensional balls. Now, we heard a kind of result on that already in the previous talk. This will be a bit different. And then the last part will be what's beyond quantum theory, maybe, a bit speculative, but also some results that we have. And I'll come to that soon, what this means. So as a motivation, let me give a quotation by John Wheeler. So in 2000, John Wheeler wrote in the New York Times, he wrote, "Quantum physics has explained the structure of atoms and molecules, the behavior of semiconductors, and the comings and goings of particles, from neutrinos to quarks. So successful, yes, but mysterious too." Right? So why does the quantum exist? Yeah, so why do we have quantum theory? This is, of course, a very deep and interesting question. And if you look in the standard textbooks, then you have all these postulates that talk about states, which are vectors in a complex Hilbert space. And what we would like to have, of course, is an operational justification or a different reason why we have this mathematical structure. There's also another part of motivation, and I'd like to tell you this little story to give you this part of motivation. So in 1989, there was this paper by Steven Weinberg with the title Testing Quantum Mechanics. And what he writes here is, this paper presents a general framework for introducing nonlinear corrections into ordinary quantum mechanics that can serve as a guide to experiments that would be sensitive to such corrections. So he proposes alternative theories that he could test in experiments against quantum theory. Now, this is very interesting, but then a few months later, there was this paper by Nicolas Chissin, Weinberg's Nonlinear Quantum Mechanics and Supraluminal Communications. So here he says that we would like in this letter to draw attention to the difficulty of modifying quantum mechanics without introducing arbitrarily fast actions at a distance. And then he writes, so below we show how to construct within Weinberg's framework an arbitrarily fast telephone line. And so this means that this original formulation of Weinberg contains signaling, supraluminal signaling in a way, and this is something that we do not want. Yeah. And what this also tells us is that it is very difficult to modify quantum theory in a way which avoids such things. Right? So if you just add some nonlinear terms, for example, it might have just these properties that we don't want. But now if we had, say, a set of axioms for quantum theory, we could just go and modify the axioms and then see what we get afterwards. So this would be a much cleaner way, and I'll say more about this at the end. Okay, so now our results, what are they? So first, they are a derivation of the full quantum formalism from operational physical axioms, and then also some methods to construct natural consistent modifications of quantum theory. Yeah? Whereas this is really the result, that we really derive the quantum formalism, and then the second part is more like a research program, what we could try out to modify the axioms and either get quantum theory again or get other theories. And of course, our work does not come from nowhere, but it's built on previous work. So first of all, on Lucy and Hardy's paper, which opened up maybe the whole field, you could say, at least in the last 10 years. And we also built heavily on the paper by Dakic and Bruckner, so we used really results from these papers, but also added a lot of new ideas to this. So if you're interested in this, then you should also read the new papers by Giulio and by Lucien. They have just given the talks here, and these are similar ideas, but with a kind of different formulation and different results as well. Okay, so now what are general probabilistic theories? So the idea is to have something like a laboratory situation in the background. So we don't really know if we have quantum theory or anything. We don't talk about this, but we just talk about preparations, transformations, and measurements like this. So we say, well, maybe we have in the lab, we have a box, and we can press a button, And then the box releases some system, which might be a particle or something else, some weird system. Then there's some transformation going on in the end. So the, say, particle passes through the transformation device, and in the end we do a measurement. And the measurement device gives us some outcome with a certain probability. So here we say, good, we assume that we have measurements with certain outcome probabilities. We have states and transformations. And then we only basically assume one additional thing, which is normally called the no signaling principle. And this basically means that we do not want to have this Weinberg problem, right? So if we have two systems at Alice and Bob's side that are far apart, then we built in from the beginning that it's impossible just to send information by measurement between Alice and Bob. This is the no signaling principle. Okay, so you can sit down and can really write down mathematically what this means, and in the end you get the framework of general probabilistic theories. Again, this is very well known by many of you, and some of these theories have been set up actually by people here in this room. But so the basic idea is not to talk in the beginning about Hilbert spaces or complex numbers or anything like this, but just to say, okay, we have these states here, we collect them in state spaces, and these are then convex sets. Why it's convex, I say something more on the next slide, but these are basically arbitrary convex sets of arbitrary dimension, and there are still many ways to combine two systems. So if Alice holds a system and Bob, there are still like many different ways to define a tensor product or something even more general, even though we have the no signaling principle. Now, if you assume this framework, and then together, in addition, these axioms here. So I afterwards go through them step by step. So these are five axioms. Then it turns out that among these, so this is a large set of possible theories. So quantum theory is one of the theories, classical probability theory, and then you have much more general theories like Boxworld and so on. And so if you additionally assume or postulate these axioms, then it turns out that only quantum theory and classical probability theory survive. Yeah? And all the other theories are ruled out. And, okay, so you might say, well, but you live in a quantum world, right? So what about classical probability theory? Can we get rid of this somehow? And this is something that Lucien also did in this paper. We can just say, okay, let's modify one of the axioms and replace reversibility by continuous reversibility. And then only quantum theory is the unique solution, right? But the result holds more generally. So in the previous talk, Lewis so assumed that we have these continuous groups, but actually we don't need it here. So here we have a reversibility and a group. I'll say more about that soon, but a group that can be just discrete. And then what you can, of course, do is you can say, okay, now I have these five axioms. Now what if I drop one of those? So let's just get rid of one of them. Depends on matter of taste which one you choose, but maybe the subspace axiom, for example. And the idea is that then maybe there are new solutions that appear here, like other theories that are consistent with these axioms as well, that would be then interesting in the sense that they are conceptually very close to quantum theory. They might be mathematically rather different, but they are then conceptually close, and we can look at them and try to analyze them. Okay. So now I told you what our results are. I should also tell you what they are not, right? So they do not offer a resolution of the measurement problem, for example. So I really just assume that some measurement takes place, has some outcome with some probability, but we do not talk about how this actually happens. Also, it's no new interpretation of quantum theory, and we just assume that probabilities exist. At the moment, it only works for finite-dimensional quantum theory. And this is maybe important to mention for people from other fields. So this is only about abstract quantum theory. So say it's not about mechanics or field theory. So Lucien has also mentioned this, but let me clarify this a bit more. So if you look at, for example, statistical mechanics, then you can say, well, this is basically two things put together. So we combine basically mechanics with Hamiltonian space and time evolution and so on together with probability theory. And what you usually learn is quantum mechanics is then just a combination of mechanics, which has Hamiltonians in it and time and space, together with what you might call abstract quantum theory, which says that states are density matrices and you have the Born rule and so on. And in this derivation of quantum theory, what we mean by quantum theories is abstract quantum theory. So here we do not talk about Hamiltonians or particular realization of quantum theory in physics. Okay, so we've seen the setup already. So how do we get to this general probabilistic framework? So first of all, we can say, well, what is a state that comes out here? How can I specify it? And then there's always a brute force way to do it. You could just make a long list of all possible measurements that you could do here and just list the probabilities of the outcomes. So you have yes, no measurements and say first measurement has probability P1 of getting yes outcome, second measurement is P2 and so on. But in many cases it turns out that actually you don't need all these infinitely many values, like for a qubit. Sometimes so all the states omega, they just span a finite dimensional subspace. In a qubit you only need 4 values basically, like what's the probability of measuring spin up in x direction and y direction and so on. So these are just the entries of your density matrix. So in fact, the state space is just 4-dimensional. And this is one of our axioms, in fact. We say, well, one axiom is that all state spaces that we consider should be finite dimensional. And often it's just a background assumption, but we decided somehow to include it as an axiom because we think it's kind of surprising that this is the fact. So there's no real a priori reason why it should boil down to finitely many values. Then, so if I have two states, omega or phi, you can imagine that you prepare now one of the two randomly, so you throw a dice or a coin and prepare one of the two with probability 1/2. And then if you see how this affects the outcome probabilities, then you see that this is just the convex combination of the two states. And this means that state spaces are in convex sets. And the extremal points in a convex geometry sense are called pure states, like these red ones here, and the others are the mixed states. Okay, then, so what are measurements and outcome probabilities? So we know that outcome probabilities should have values between 0 and 1. So I can put in a state psi and compute an outcome probability E of psi. And since this should respect the probabilistic mixture, this should be a linear map or an effect. And so we see, for example, that here are the lines of like constant value of the effect. So it could be that on this state, the outcome probability is 1. Here it might be 0. And then on this line, it's, for example, 0.7. And then a measurement is just a collection of many of those outcomes where the probability sums to 1. Okay. Now, another axiom that we have is that all measurements are physically possible. So this means the following. So suppose you know your state space, or you have your state space given, like this one. And then every map that you can construct with these properties should be in principle possible to implement. So our axiom says that every such effect corresponds to a real measurement that I could in principle do. So this kind of means that there are no, say, super selection rules that forbid some of the measurements. So this we don't want. Okay. So we have talked about states and measurements. Now come the transformations. So transformations should map input states to output states, and they should be linear because they also have to respect the probabilistic structure. Now reversible transformations are those that can be reversed, right? So there's an inverse transformation that just undoes the under transformation, and they form a group. In quantum theory, this is just the group of conjugations with unitaries. And so if you want a picture of those, then it turns out, so what they do is they map the state space into itself. So these are symmetries of the state space. For example, for this strange state space here, you might say, well, so these rotations here might be reversible transformations, right? So here I rotate by 120 degrees counterclockwise, or I do this twice, for example, and these can be undone, so this could be reversible transformations. Then it turns out not all those symmetries of your state space need to be reversible transformations. For example, for a qubit, which is just a 3-dimensional ball, it's clear that so the group that you can actually implement physically is just SO3. So this is only rotations and no reflections. And this means, so what this means is that if we had a reflection, this would be a partial transposition, and this would not be a completely positive map. So this means that we can say a system is just a pair where we have a state space and then the group of reversible transformations on that state space. So then second axiom, which also Lewis in his talk mentioned, is reversibility. So if we have two pure states, phi and omega, then there should be a reversible transformation which maps the one state to the other state. This would be true for all pairs of pure states. So what that means as a picture is that it enforces some symmetry in your state space. For example, this is perfectly satisfied for a Bloch ball, of course. The pure states are the states on the boundary, and by a rotation, you can map every point to every other on the surface. It would not be possible for this state space because these two red states are pure, but there is no reversible transformation, 120-degree rotation, that can map one of those to the other. But a square, for example, would be fine again. This is just by rotations, reflections, you can map every one of the four pure states to every other. Okay, now this is about non-locality and local tomography. You also heard that before, let me nevertheless repeat it. So we have Alice and we have Bob, and both have a laboratory at home, and they share some state which is a global state and it might have correlations. And correlations means that both of them can do their local measurements and then compare the outcomes afterwards. And the first condition that I mentioned before is the no signaling conditions, which means that the choice of Bob's measurement should not affect the probabilities of Alice's measurement outcomes. Because otherwise, they could be arbitrarily far apart and could just send messages with this. Right? But then we want a bit more. So what we want is that local tomography holds, and this means that states on AB are uniquely determined by the correlations of the local measurements. So if Alice and Bob have this state and they want to find out what state it is, by tomography, it's just enough to do local measurements. So they don't need this kind of strange non-local measurement, but it's okay just to do local measurements to distinguish the state. And this gives you already the tensor product structure for the state space, basically. Okay. So we've seen this already, and these are the axioms again. I talked to you now about four of these axioms, but there's one missing, which is the subspace axiom. And the subspace axiom was also in Lucien's first paper. And here's a picture of about why it is physically reasonable to assume this. Yeah, so suppose you have some three-level system. It might be a quantum system with three energy levels, or some strange system with just three possibilities that you can distinguish. And suppose that for some reason it is impossible to find your state or your system in the third energy level. Yeah, so you prepare the system in many ways, very often in your lab, and you never find the particle in the third level. So what does it mean? Well, it basically means that it is a two-level system, right? And this, yeah, in fact, we use this always in physics when we talk about small systems or states with, say, two distinguishable states, and they're always part of a larger system. Now, in quantum theory, so what you have is that if you have a 3x3 density matrix and one state is just forbidden, you basically get a 2x2 density matrix. In classical probability theory, the 3 vector and one probability 0 gives you just a 2 outcome probability distribution. And so the subspace axiom says that these situations are just the same. So if one perfectly distinguishable possibility never appears, then I get something which has just one possibility less, right? And, well, if this was not be true, if this was not true, then we would live in a very strange world where, say, some kind of dragon states would really affect your physics, right? So, like, impossible potentialities, like just knowing that your system could in principle be found in this state, but it will never be found in this state, would then change your state space. And this would be a very weird place. So this is why this axiom makes sense. And here's a more formal formulation. So we have two systems. One has capacity n, and one has capacity n minus 1. I'll say in a second what capacity means, right? Let me just read it for the beginning. So then we have a complete measurement on omega n, and then the set of states which give probability 0, and the last outcome is equivalent to omega n minus 1. So what does that mean? So the capacity on a state space is the maximal number of perfectly distinguishable states. For a qubit, for example, it's 2. And perfectly distinguishable means that you have a measurement that gives probabilities 0 or 1 in a single-shot manner. So you can distinguish those states perfectly just with a single use of your apparatus. And we call it complete if it's maximal, so if it cannot be distinct, so if there is no other measurement that can distinguish more states than it is a complete measurement. And equivalent here means, so equivalent just means that the state spaces are the same up to an affine or linear transformation. Because if we have a qubit on the one hand or some distorted qubit, where you distort the measurements in the same way inversely, it just gives the same probabilities. So there's no physical difference between the two situations. Okay, so these are basically the axioms that we have. And now maybe the most interesting part is a sketch of the proof. So why, for example, is a bit a ball and why is it three-dimensional? And to start with, let's look at a bit. And a bit is just some state space with capacity 2. Now we know by convex geometry that we can always find such a state like this omega 0 that has a supporting hyperplane, which is in this case just a line, a straight line, that intersects only the state. And then we can, of course, translate this line to the other side of state space. And then we can interpret these lines as the lines of constant value for some measurement. So we say, this describes a measurement with its outcome probability 0 over here and outcome probability 1 over there. And let's call this measurement E. Now, this is some linear map that we can write down. And since we have this all measurements allowed axiom, we know that this is a valid measurement. And now the subspace axiom tells us, well, now if you take this measurement and you look at those states where one of the outcome probabilities is 0, then this should be omega, the state space with one capacity less. Yeah, but one less than 2 is 1. So this is state space with capacity 1. But if you see what states these are, this is just one state, namely this one, omega 0. And so we conclude that state space of capacity 1 contains only one single state. Now, suppose we have a state space like this one, which has a face. So say this red line here, right? So why is this impossible? So suppose we have this face, then we can just do the same thing as above. We can construct a measurement corresponding to the dashed lines. And then reasoning just in the same way gives us now that the state space of capacity 1 has infinitely many states, right? Because all these states on the red line must be contained in that. And this is a contradiction. So the state space doesn't have faces. And if it doesn't have faces, it could look like that, for example. This is like a droplet. It's not very symmetric, but it has no face nowhere, right? This is possible now. But then, so Lewis talked a lot about that. We have this group of reversible transformations. And if we do some group theory, just a very basic thing, then we see that the state space must be much more symmetric than this droplet. So it must be basically an ellipsoid or a ball, and we can always represent it as a ball. So this is another way, in addition to the one that Lewis already mentioned, where you can derive that a bit is a ball. Okay. So what do we do next? Well, let's just go through a few steps. So we prove there is a maximally mixed state, and the product of two maximally mixed states is the maximally mixed state on the composition. It's a bit technical. I just maybe quickly go through that. Then you prove that you can decompose your maximally mixed state in a certain way. And then after a while, this is something that Lucien has done as well. You derive that the dimension of this bit, yeah, this is a ball of some dimension. We don't know the dimension yet. But this dimension must be of the form 2 to the r minus 1. So it must either be 1 or 3 or 7 or 15 or 31 or whatever. Just some of those values. Good. Now, what about the case where this is just one-dimensional? So if you have a one-dimensional ball, well, a one-dimensional ball is something like this here on the left. This is just a classical bit. And if we see that, so if you look at how the state spaces with capacity 3 and 4 and so on turn out, then you see it's easy to show that this actually gives you classical probability theory. So this case of a one-dimensional bit is classical probability theory. Now, what about the other cases, 3, 7, 15, and so on? What you would like to have is that first prove that only 3 is possible, and then if you have dimension 3, prove that you get exactly quantum theory. And that's what we did. So first, This is also something that Lewis already mentioned. Since we have this reversibility axiom, we know that our group, which acts on the state space, is transitive on the sphere. It maps every pure state on the sphere to every other. And, well, then you saw the list already before. You can just classify the groups that are transitive on the sphere. And it turns out that if dimension is even, then there are really many possibilities. And Lewis showed you some of those. But if the dimension is odd, then there are much fewer possibilities. And it's a very strange thing that the dimension 7 is kind of special. So if dimension is not 7, then there's only the orthogonal group. But if the dimension is 7, which is still possible, so 7 is on our list, unfortunately, there's also the strange Lie group, this exceptional Lie group G2 that we have to consider. This is a bit of a strange coincidence that 7 has this particular feature. But fortunately, we know that the dimension must be odd, so we can rule out all these cases now, and this makes things a lot easier for the rest. Okay. So now suppose we don't have one, but we have two bits, and we know, so we're interested in the group of transformations on two bits. What we know is that we can do local transformations, so we can, on the first bit, we can apply G2, this group on a bit. And on the second bit, we can also apply this group and the tensor product of the two. But are there more transformations? And so to analyze this, let's just concentrate on the case where dimension is not 7. So if the dimension is not 7, then we have, locally, we have the orthogonal group. And what we did now is the following. So we looked at the first bit, and on the first bit, we chose two states, one on the north pole, one on the south pole, like omega 0 and omega 1, and they are perfectly distinguishable. And now let's look at omega 0 times omega 0 and omega 1 times omega 1. So these two symmetric states here, and they can still be perfectly distinguished. But so we have two states that can be perfectly distinguished, so they are a bit. And we know from our subspace axiom that then the phase which is generated by these two states must again be a ball. So it's again a bit and has a ball state space. And so these states here and the phase which is generated by them, so they're invariant with respect to rotations that leave the z-axis as it is, right? So if you do a transformation which leaves the axis invariant, then these states just stay the same. And these are the groups SOD minus 1 times SOD minus 1. Now you can just see what does it mean for this phase and for this subspace. And you can use group theory to count the dimensions. And then it turns out that, say, the smaller bit fits into the two larger bits only if SOD minus 1 is complex reducible, so if you can decompose it into subspaces. So in a way, like if you want to take home message from this talk, that you can say that the Bloch ball is three-dimensional because the group SOD minus 1 is complex reducible only for dimension 3. And, well, yeah, we might call this an intuitive reason or not for having a qubit, but, it's at least one that was the main reason for getting the qubit here. Yeah, so dimension 3 is the only possibility, and, I won't go through this here maybe. So now we know that locally we have a qubit state space, and we can just see what about the state spaces with larger capacities. So we can start, for example, by doing this map here, L, and L maps the three-dimensional ball to the 2x2 Hermitian matrices. And this is, in the end, the fact why you get complex numbers or Hilbert spaces or density matrices, because the three-dimensional ball has this nice representation. Okay, now if you combine more than one bit or two or three bits, then you can just have a look at some facts in universal quantum computation, say apply Wigner's theorem and some other tricks to finally prove that actually you get exactly quantum theory. So if you want to formulate that mathematically, you would say, okay, then every theory that satisfies the five axioms, which is not classical probability theory, must be equivalent, so can be represented as omega n and gn, and omega n are just the density matrices on the complex Hilbert space Cn, And the group is exactly the group of unitaries that act by conjugation. And then the measurements turn out to be exactly the positive operator valued measures. Okay. So yeah, this was a little sketch on how we derived quantum theory. And now if you compare different versions or approaches to getting quantum theory in the end, it's always a bit difficult because some approaches, for example, assume that you can swap two bits, and other approaches assume that you cannot necessarily swap two bits, and so on. So we have these five axioms, but then, of course, you have these background assumptions like convexity, closedness, and so on. So this is, of course, also part of the theorem that we have these background assumptions. Okay. Now, one motivation, as I said, of this approach was to get new theories in the end. So really, if you have these five axioms and drop one of them, say maybe the subspace axiom, then you can ask, so what happens now? Do I still get only quantum theory or something new and interesting? And this is just a mention of the result that Lewis just talked about. So there's a student of him involved. I don't recall his name. But he's also here and gives his poster. And Tony Short, I guess, is involved, and also Jonathan Oppenheim. So if the local state space is a ball of some dimension, then entanglement and continuous reversibility give you that only dimension three is possible, right? So this also gives you quantum theory for two bits. And they don't assume the subspace axiom, but all the other axioms are assumed there. So this is one direction that you can go, so proving quantum theory from even less axioms. The other direction that you can go is you say, well, let's try to find properties and just prove properties of these other theories that are out there that satisfy only two or three of these axioms and that generalize quantum theory. And this is what I did with Oscar and Vladko recently, where you just say, okay, let's look at state spaces that have some transformation group on them. So you might call them dynamical state spaces because there's this group, which could be a time evolution. It could also be a computation. And then it turns out that many things that we like or love from the quantum world carry nicely over to these more general state spaces. For example, you can define a generalized notion of purity and of Pauli operators. Also of the Clifford group and the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. And so many structural things just carry over to these other possible theories. Also, you can give a formula for like the typical entanglement in the random bipartite state or a decoupling theorem in these cases. And so, well, the hope is that the two approaches kind of meet in the middle at some point, right? So from one side, you try to break down quantum theory to less and less axioms. And from the other side, you would like to map out properties of other theories and then find the sharp boundary between the two in the end. Okay, that's basically it. So this is our paper, if you're interested. And here are two new papers by Giulio and co-authors, and also by Lucien. So if you're interested in this approach, you could check them out and the references there. Yes, so thanks for your attention.
So we do have a bit of time for questions. First.
Why is it that you required the complex reducibility? I sort of missed it.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back. Okay. So you have the subspace axiom. This tells you, okay, there are two states, this omega 0 times omega 0, omega 1 times omega 1, and now they generate a bit themselves because they are two of them. And a bit, we know that, is now a ball, a d-dimensional ball. So what we can do now is we can just start with, say, omega 0 times omega 0, this one state, and then apply all reversible transformations that you have to them and look at the orbit that you get, right? And it turns out that this orbit is just too large to be a d-dimensional ball. It has much larger dimension. If this group acts irreducibly, right? So this kind of fits, so the subspace is too large to fit into the global state space if we have irreducibility, because irreducibility just means that there is no invariant subspace, but it mixes everything through in a way. And in this case, you do not all transformations, but only local ones, which fix this axis. And these are, again, orthogonal transformations, but of one dimension less. This is why I talk about SOD minus one. And if you apply them all, like then you know you must, what you get should be exactly a d-dimensional ball again. And then you count dimensions with group representation theory.
Actually, you've talked of going from abstract quantum theory to quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. Have there been tried to rederive quantum mechanics from this kind of operational approach?
That's a good question. I think this would be really great to do, and there are some approaches to that already. So you could ask, for example, well, to formulate quantum field theory, for example, in an operational way. But then I guess a nice approach to do this is not really talk about the convex sets themselves, but apply a circuit framework, for example, one that Lucien uses or that Giulio uses. For example, Lucien has set up exactly this to attack like quantum gravity one day, right? So this is some, I think this is in the back of our heads that you want to apply this to physics at a certain point, and maybe we should do it soon and see what you get. Now, so far, you're right, there's no mechanics in it, and it's purely abstract.
Thanks. So one could take the attitude that you learn something not just from the statement of the theorems, but also from the technique used in proving the theorems. If you look at the recent demonstrations that you don't need this simplicity axiom, then there are sort of, there's the approach due to Chaslov and Dakic. There's the approach due to Giulio, Amaro, and Paolo. And then there's this sort of more group theoretic approach. And I think the first two approaches are kind of more physical in the insights they provide. You know, for example, if it's related to teleportation, then you get a sense that you're learning something about physics. And I don't see that in the group theoretic approach to the same extent, but maybe you do because you've worked with it. Do you have any sort of physical intuitions about why this works?
That's a very good question. It would be good to have an intuitive understanding of this, but I don't see this as an intuitive argument. It seems to be a very powerful one because, as you just saw, you can extend it to more general situations where you have, so you don't assume all the five axioms, but drop the subspace axiom, and then you have like Lewis results. This is the same, say, abstract approach, which even in this case then rules out dimension three for you. So it singles out dimension three. So I think it's very powerful, but I don't know what it physically means, actually. It's a good question. No idea.
Any more questions?
You said at one point that this approach doesn't solve the measurement problem. It's not a new interpretation of quantum mechanics, and that's not really your goal. But in this generalized framework, how would you formulate the measurement problem? And how do you know that there's not a way within this framework to solve it? What would the measurement problem be?
Yes, that's true in a way, but I think one has to differentiate different formalisms that you can use. So in this one that we used, for example, a measurement means that your system is basically destroyed. So it enters the detector and then it's just gone. So there is, for example, no post-measurement state in this formalism. But you could talk about post-measurement states, especially if you have circuits that have ingoing and outgoing systems. And then you have something that happens in the circuit, right, which might be, collapse or something. I mean, it's a difficult question. It depends also what you exactly mean by measurement problem. You could, even in classical probability theory, you could say, well, if I throw a coin and I didn't look, then it's in a mixture, and then I look and suddenly it collapses to heads, right? So is this a measurement problem or not? Maybe it is, and maybe you wonder about it or you don't, right? So it's a difficult question, but this one doesn't solve the measurement problem, but it also contains it in a way, I guess. That's what I would say.
Do you have any comments on that, Jeff?
No. So I've excuse me. So I've got a comment on that. At one point you said that you're assuming probability theory, or you're assuming probabilities. Is that what you said? Did I get that right?
Right.
Okay, so at what level are you assuming it? Because it sounds like, to me, it sounds like it's a very benign assumption to say there's something out there, I'm going to poke it, and I don't know what's going to happen when I do, but I'm going to make some predictions about it. Is that it, or is there more that you're assuming?
So you could, of course, say abstractly, we assume, say, the Kolmogorov axioms, like of probability theory, right? So it should be a value between 0 and 1, for example, and this is built into this effects notion. So if you apply it to a state, you get something between 0 and 1, right? So in a way, we are assuming classical probabilities, but in a very abstract way. And then you can additionally ask, what is the physical assumption between that? Does it really mean that that I do have some real indeterminism in my system, or is it something that's in my head, or not? Like, but I think these questions are independent of whether you use the standard formalism of quantum theory or if you use this probabilistic, this operational framework. And so I said, yes, we use probability theory, but no, we do not know exactly how we use it. Right?
Are there any more questions or comments? If not, then let's thank Marcus again.